All right. So good afternoon and thank you for joining us today. And I want to give a big thank you to Aaron Szabo, who will be speaking with us this hour. So Aaron is Senior Director at Faegre Drinker. And this interview is an element of IRI's sustainability community. And the sustainability community provides resources and networking opportunities for members as you promote sustainability in your innovation practices. So through this, you can access facilitated roundtable discussions on key topics. These are the fourth Thursday of every month. So we'll be having, sorry, the fourth Friday of every month. So we'll be having one tomorrow. And we do case studies and white papers with industry examples. We've got one coming out on Henkel in a couple months. And then we do updates and insights with additional resources and then thought leader interviews like we're doing today. So I'll make sure that all of you get updates on these sorts of things. And if you don't want to receive them, just let me know. As I say, I don't like to send people mail what they don't want. So just a few housekeeping items to get through before we can begin the conversation with Aaron. So first, this session is being recorded and you will get a link to the recording. We'll be distributing the recording as a podcast, so we won't have any visuals here today. And second, please hold all your questions until the end. And then once we open the floor to questions, you can type your questions into the chat and I'll read it out for you. Or you can come on video and ask your question face to face, which I do encourage because it makes for a richer conversation. All right, let's go ahead and get started. So, Aaron, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me here.
Could you tell us about your background and the work that you do at Faegre Drinker?
Sure. Thanks, Lee. Yeah, so I'm Aaron Szabo. I'm a senior director at Faegre Drinker. It's an international law firm with offices around the United States, UK, where I really specialize in environment, energy, and manufacturing issues. Specifically, I advise on environmental and energy regulations and their impact on clients, businesses, and practices, and counsel companies on their strategic business decisions affected by these environmental and energy policies. I also advise businesses on engaging with federal agencies during the development of these federal policies and rules, as well as for compliance. Although my current focus, which is probably the focus of many people, is on PFAS and the significant number of PFAS actions that have been coming out and assisting companies with their compliance and mitigating potential risks related to PFAS. Before Faegre Drinker, I spent over 10 years in the United States federal government, including 4 years in the White House across both the Obama and Trump administrations, focusing on environmental and energy issues. A good way to think about it is I've worked on essentially every U.S. EPA major climate action between 2014 to 2018 is a good way to think about it. But it was more than just climate change while I was there. So, but happy to be here. Thanks.
All right. Thanks. So we'd be remiss in a discussion on regulations to not discuss PFAS. So let's just get it out of the way to start with. So can you give us an update?
Sure. I will give a relatively short update because we could be talking for days on PFAS because there's a lot going on around the world with respect to PFAS. We're seeing actions in the United States, both at the federal and state level. Internationally, we're seeing actions by the United Nations and, of course, the European Union. We're seeing everything from additional reporting requirements to outright bans of products that contain PFAS. So it's wide, ranging. This is also usually when I'll give my disclaimer that I'm not a scientist. So
That's fine. We got plenty on here. Don't worry.
Please don't ask me about chemical compositions. But I think we need to start kind of where to start with PFAS is what are PFAS? Unfortunately, there doesn't seem to be an international agreement on what PFAS are. In the United States, there's no standard federal government definition for PFAS. And then U.S. states have their own definition of PFAS. And none of these definitions appear to be in line with what the Europeans' definition of PFAS is. So sometimes the definition of PFAS in a regulation or law is just a list of chemical substances, and other times it's a structural definition. So for companies, you may be required to do something because you're a PFAS under one regulation or one jurisdiction, but you might not be defined as a PFAS in another regulation or jurisdiction. Of course, not making it easy for companies to figure out what you need to do. Going into what's going on, starting with the White House, in the United States, sorry, in general, we've seen a flurry of recent activities at the federal level. I've been calling April 2024 as the EPA designated PFAS month, as they put out a number of actions over the past 4 weeks. These actions are from notices to collect more information on PFAS to declaring PFOA and PFOS, two of the more recognized versions of PFAS, as hazardous substance under the Superfund law or CERCLA. This, of course, is on top of the hundreds of companies working on compliance with EPA's PFAS reporting rule that came out late last year that is due next year. I could go into detail on these, but we wouldn't have time to talk about anything else, and I probably wouldn't get through everything anyways. But if you are interested in more detail on these actions, you know, feel free to reach out to me or check Fake Drinker's website, as we have a number of client alerts on everything that's kind of going on with PFAS, definitely at the federal level. At the state level in the United States, we have multiple states moving forward with banning products with intentionally added PFAS. So that's usually been the big thing at the state level, is if you intentionally add PFAS, whereas at the United States federal level, it doesn't matter how PFAS got into your product, it's just that it's there. States are also providing exemptions for these product bans. So if your company is not already engaging with states on potential product bans, it's probably a good idea to try and start engaging one way or another, or at least figuring out, do your products contain PFAS and could they be banned under one of these state laws? Now let's turn to the PFAS requirements within the European Union and what that means for companies that manufacture, sell into, or use PFAS. So the EU has been regulating PFOS, one of the big name PFAS since 2009, when the chemical was added into the Stockholm Convention, and has been restricted in the EU for more than 10 years under the EU's Persistent Organic Pollutants, or POP, regulations. PFOA, another one of those long chain ones, has been banned under the POP regulations since 2020, and the EU added PFHXS in 2023 to the POP regulations in response to the Stockholm Convention adding that as well. Additionally, the EU has been evaluating a wide-scale PFAS restriction proposal for the past 5 years. This current proposal being evaluated is from 5 different countries: Germany, Denmark, Netherlands, Norway, and Sweden. The European Chemicals Agency, which regulates chemicals in the EU, received over 5,600 comments from 4,400 different organizations, companies, and individuals, with a significant number of comments coming from Germany, Japan, and Sweden, although Sweden actually had a national campaign. I'm sure many, if not all, the companies on this call have been involved or are engaging through a trade association. There's been a lot of interest, of course, in this wide-scale PFAS action. Where we are right now is those countries who submitted those proposals, those 5 countries, are taking all the comments that have been submitted, which there were thousands, and then we'll be reassessing it, and then we'll submit it back to the respective committees within the European Chemicals Agency, who will then provide final opinions to the European Commission. So it seems there was originally a plan for those final opinions to be submitted last month. There are more meetings later this year. So it seems like, you know, we do have some time before this gets finalized, and there's a lot going on. Specifically, what does this proposal look like? Well, it's looking at banning PFAS in specific sectors. Those sectors are textiles, upholstery, leather, apparel, and carpets, or TULOC; food contact materials and packaging; metal plating and manufacturing of metal products; consumer mixtures; cosmetics; ski wax; applications of fluorinated gases; medical devices; transportation; electronics and semiconductors; the energy sector; construction productions; lubricants; and petroleum mining. So it's a lot of sectors there that we're looking at. Not everyone, but they're also looking at both a quick phase out as well as a longer term 5 to 12 year phase out of PFAS in these various sectors. Additionally, EPA is also currently phasing out the use of PFAS in firefighting foam. So there's a lot of sectors that are going on, a lot of consideration. I know there's a lot of concern related to how broad this would apply and how companies would comply with this in the future. But that's not the only thing the EU is doing. The EU has also added several PFAS on the candidate list of substances of very high concern, or SVHC, under the REACH regulations, the chemical regulation, as well as their petitions to include additional PFAS on the candidate list. So what does this mean if they're added on the candidates list? So PFAS being included means the products that contain PFAS at levels in excess of 0.1% must disclose the presence of those items within 45 days upon request for consumers or customers. For companies that are manufacturing or reporting over 1 metric ton or above the 0.1 threshold, they must notify the European Chemicals Agency within 6 months of it being added into the list. And additionally, they have to be added to safety data sheets, so a lot more reporting requirements on that as well. And then the EU, like the United States recently did, have set drinking water standards for some PFAS and have been moving forward with evaluating and restricting certain PFAS in food packaging. The European Food Safety Authority sets those standards and have for several of those long chain PFAS. As I mentioned, this is kind of a somewhat quick high level update on kind of what's going on PFAS, but it's a lot of action, a lot of things moving along, a lot more reporting with a large potential of additional bans coming, and happy to talk about that more, but figured, you know, didn't want to spend the whole time here just talking about PFAS.
There's one small thread I do want to pull on. You mentioned that states are talking about intentionality. How do you manage that? How do you prove that?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question that I think the states themselves are still trying to figure out. It is what they are distinguishing there, at least when they talk about intentionally added, is let's say if you're a company that uses a lot of water, and that water might already be contaminated with PFAS. If there's any cross-contamination, you could still sell that product. What they're really looking at is, did you coat your product with PFAS? Did you add PFAS into your product? And as you said, how do you know? That's a big supply chain question. That is one of the big concerns is, you know, you might not have added PFAS to your knowledge into the product, but one of your suppliers well down the supply chain might have done that as well. So there's questions on, you know, the unknown unknowns type situation that also raises concerns, and the states are still trying to figure that out. In fact, Maine, one of the first to do the kind of large bans, just recently changed their law last month to try and help resolve some of the many concerns that are coming in about that.
Okay. All right, that makes more sense. Okay, so back to Europe. You mentioned REACH rules. What are these all about?
Sure, yeah. So REACH is the regulation that governs the European Union's manufacturing and importing of chemical substances. REACH stands for Registration, Evaluation, and Authorization of Chemicals, and it's been in place since 2007. It's overseen and administered by the European Chemicals Agency, similar to, as I was mentioning, with PFAS. As I said, this is your main chemicals law, and it's potentially unwieldy and complex. It's a very complex law, like many chemical laws. But as the name of the rule sounds, REACH, there's a registration, evaluation, authorization requirements. That also includes reporting and restriction requirements that tie into those categories. This applies to all companies that manufacture, distribute, import, use, and applies across many sectors of the economy. So let's start with what the registration requirements are. Companies that import or manufacture 1 ton or more of the chemical substance have to register with the European Chemicals Agency. And for articles, so those are similar to products, there's some differentiating there. I'll just use articles and products kind of interchangeably, although they're not technically interchangeable. If you're importing an article into the EU, and if there's more than 1 metric ton of the chemical substance within the articles that could be expected to release, or if they contain those substances of very high concern, like some of the PFAS, you would also need to register that. So an example of one of those would be like a scented candle or a scented object, so it's releasing things. And of course, if it is a new chemical, then the company must conduct a risk assessment and submit that information to the European Chemicals Agency. And of course, after you register your chemical, there are appropriate labels that you might need to apply to the chemical and the product as well. With respect to the SVHCs, they're the ones that get the most attention. They are the ones that may have a serious and often irreversible effect on human health and the environment.
Sorry, what's an SVHC?
Oh, sorry. That's a substance of very high concern. I will keep just saying substance of very high concern. As I said, I use a lot of acronyms.
It's okay. We're in DC. That's what happens here.
So the REACH regulation has authorization requirements for substances of very high concern with the goal, the stated goal under REACH is to replace them with less dangerous substances or technologies where technologically and economically feasible alternatives are available. So the idea is getting away from substances of very high concern if you can. They're governed by a two-step process. The first step is what's called the candidate list. This is a little bit of a misnomer because even if it's on the candidate list, there are still requirements that kicked in, that can kick in. And these are any substances that have been proposed by a European member state or the European Chemicals Agency as being a risk to human and or environmental health. It does require a 45-day consultation period, but once identified, it does trigger legal obligations for companies manufacturing, importing, or using the substances. So a candidate is kind of the candidate to potentially be what is the second step, which is the authorization list. So this is the what basically more requirements kick in. So, yeah, the European Chemicals Agency, they prioritize candidate substances that are given to persistent bioaccumulative or and toxic or PBTs or very persistent and very bioaccumulative or are in high volume market distribution. So these are, they're going to focus on the those three kind of categories as things that they'll pull from the candidate list to put on the authorization list first. Once you're on the authorization list, these substances cannot be placed into the EU market or used after a sunset date unless the manufacturer, importer, or user is granted authorization for the specific use or the use is exempted. To note, like this, if a company does have an application for an authorized use, the company can still manufacture, import, or use until the product decision is made. So it's not necessary that you have to have an okay first. You just need to have your application pending at least. And when it comes to restrictions under this authorization use, they can be to specific substances or specific uses. Those kind of restriction process also goes through its own consultation process. So what is this all? The REACH is an extremely complicated regulation. What does REACH mean for companies and kind of where are we going in the future? The increase in substances being added to the SVHC candidate list is putting additional pressure on companies. Knowing what's in your supply chain, we were talking about this with PFAS, knowing what's in your supply chain is becoming even more important as there are more and more restrictions and labeling requirements coming to fruition. The process is also becoming more and more complex because of that, meaning that companies are needing to hire outside assistance more often. There are some benefits if you're a small company, but it's still a very complex statute. Things are getting more complex. The supply chain is getting more complex. So it really helps to have outside consultation. This is leading to questions for if you're an international company, that where to locate your manufacturing is becoming more complex. To what extent do you need to worry about chemical regulations changing, potentially preventing you from continuing to be able to make your product? Unfortunately, unlike a lot of other issues, chemical regulations are extremely hard to push back on for both regulators who as well as companies. As I kind of talked about, chemical substances themselves are difficult to even pronounce. I can't pronounce most of them. And that's why I always use acronyms. Much less explain why it's okay for them to be in someone's drinking water, air, or soil. Especially once a chemical is deemed hazardous or harmful by anyone, any regulator, you rarely, if ever, see that chemical being reevaluated and determined that it was not as harmful as previously determined. So it's really a one-way ratchet to when it comes to chemicals. Now, comparing is the United States or Europe friendlier when it comes to chemical regulations? It's very similar whether you're manufacturing or selling those chemicals or products that use those chemicals between the United States and Europe. There's different regulatory as well as different legal schemes between the United States and Europe, but essentially for all companies, either way, before you enter the EU or United States market, or if you're already in the EU and US market, you really need to consider what your supply chain is and how much supply chain analysis you might need to do in the future.
Okay.
Sorry, that's a lot.
That's a lot. That's
you know,
lot.
As I said, that was also a very high level, quick and, you know, down and dirty version. Yeah.
And it's ridiculously complicated, and that's why we have you here. So it's hard for all of us to understand. All right. So the other one is the carbon border adjustment. And, you know, the EU has the free movement of people, but apparently it does not do free movement of carbon. So is that what we're dealing with here?
So, yeah, I mean, kind of. Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, first, you know, there's a lot of questions we get about carbon border adjustment, what the EU is doing, as well as potentially in the US or around the world. And it's incredibly confusing and incredibly difficult. Let's start off with what a carbon border adjustment is. It's also called a carbon border adjustment mechanism, or CBAM. That's what it's called in the United States. And essentially, it's a tariff. It's a tariff on imported products based on the amount of greenhouse gas emissions. So not nearly just carbon. Now, interestingly enough, the EU is mostly carbon dioxide, but also includes other greenhouse gases sometimes. But the whole point is that this is just a tariff on import products that are released during the manufacturing of that product. Also, like all tariffs, they will inherently increase the cost to purchase those tariff products, which will raise prices for anyone who uses those tariff products as part of their supply chain, and of course, increase costs to consumers as well, one way or another. So what are the stated benefits behind a carbon border adjustment? They follow basically this fundamental premise. First, unlike other air pollutants, like hazardous air pollutants, greenhouse gases emissions are not region-based, such that one ton of carbon dioxide being emitted in Italy has the same environmental impact as one ton of carbon dioxide being emitted from Brazil. This also means that countries are required to pay for the impacts of greenhouse gases, even if that country has not emitted greenhouse gases. The other underlying premise is that manufacturing that product within the country or region would result in lower greenhouse gases than if the product was imported. So that's a very important thing, is that there has to be that delta between the two. And the country that is theoretically installing this carbon border adjustment actually has lower greenhouse gas emissions. It would not really make sense to do it the other way. Now, within those stated benefits, they fall into two main categories, the arguments that you'll hear about the value of a carbon border adjustment. The first is what I call a nationalistic category, and I'll go into more detail on that. And the second, of course, is reducing greenhouse gas emission category. Within the nationalistic category, like all tariffs, the main argument is that this carbon border adjustment levels the playing field between domestic manufacturers and importing companies. Since the country or region has more stringent environmental standards, lower greenhouse gas reductions, the domestic manufacturers are already paying to reduce their emissions, whereas importers, especially from countries with less stringent environmental standards, are getting the free ride. So they're not having to expend that cost. They can keep their products cheap. What a carbon border adjustment does is requires companies to theoretically pay for that difference. An ideal one would be one that is exactly perfect, and raise the price of those goods so that they were bound by the same greenhouse gas requirements that domestic manufacturers are. Second, within that nationalistic category, is that foreign importers may decide that it's not worth paying that carbon border adjustment, or be concerned about further increases to that cost, and instead decide to relocate within the country or region that the carbon border adjustment means. So this can help improve any trade deficits and help a country to become more self-reliant. Additionally, this foreign domestic investment results in additional manufacturing with the country, and the ultimate bipartisan issue of creating jobs. Everyone likes to talk about more jobs in their country, and so that's one of the big selling points. And then finally, of course, under the nationalistic category is the revenue from the carbon border adjustment. It is a tariff. That tariff would theoretically go back into the pot of money for the federal government. So this provides them additional funding for domestic issues, or even reduce taxes on their own constituents. Now, the greenhouse gas benefits side. As I talked, you know, how much greenhouse gas emissions are from the imported product. You'll pay less if you're an importing company by reducing your greenhouse gases, and that reduce how much a company needs to pay. They could move into the country, which would also reduce greenhouse gases. And so what this ends up doing is that it would result in greenhouse gases around the world theoretically decreasing. Additionally, as I mentioned, with the revenue, those revenues from the tariffs could be used for research and development into new greenhouse gas reduction schemes. which could also result in greenhouse gas reduction. So some sort of carbon capture type R&D. So that's the easy part. Now I'm going to go to the extremely hard part, which...
That seemed like the hard part. Okay.
That's the easy part. And this is where the rubber meets the road, as everyone says. And that's the implementation. And this is where we can get into the impacts for companies who both manufacture within the European Union as well as import into the EU. So the first implementation question for anyone is, who does this carbon border adjustment apply to? Do you want a whole of the economy carbon border adjustment? Or do you, like what the EU is doing, want to implement the carbon border adjustment on a sector-by-sector basis? The EU is starting with cement, iron and steel, aluminum, fertilizer, electricity, and hydrogen, which are the industries the EU says have the highest greenhouse gas emissions and that the EU already is implementing an internal carbon training program for. So within the EU, there's a carbon training program for those sectors. So they believe that, you know, we have the most knowledge about those. So the second, that's the easiest part of the implementation. Let's go to more difficult. We'll step through the various implementation things everyone needs to do, because I think this is really important. The second one is, how is the regulator going to perform emissions accounting of those imports, and how are companies going to do this? Will you be covering only direct emissions, so those emissions from the facility itself, or will you also be covering indirect emissions, such as from power plants that provide energy to the facility? Indirect emissions make this process even more difficult. The third and extremely difficult implementation question is, how do you enforce and inspect the greenhouse gas emission numbers you are receiving from companies? As mentioned, as we talked about before, global supply chains are extremely complex, even for items that seem rather simple. So let's take a ballpoint pen, one right here. It's something everyone has on their table usually.
I love it. A prop. Awesome.
Yes. Yeah. So you have a plastic, a ballpoint pen, you have plastic, a spring, some ink, and probably some glue. Very basic. So let's start with the plastic. Well, you can't start with plastic. You have to really think about how the plastic is made. Well, that plastic is made by drilling oil and using a refinery and distillation process to create plastic itself, which is then formed. Now, there might be other chemicals that have been added to that plastic to make it more efficient, so that would also need to be accounted for. The countries that drill for oil, refine, and distill the oil and then make the plastic may be the same country or maybe multiple countries. Then we have the spring. The tiny little spring. Well, the spring is probably steel. So, of course, we have to determine how the steel is made, which requires mining iron and then smelting. Once again, those could be done in the same country or different countries and by completely different companies. And none of them could be made at the same place or same country as the plastic is. Then we have the ink. Well, the ink is made using solvents like benzyl alcohol and dyes. You once again run into the same situation. And then last but not least, is the actual assembly of these products into the pens themselves, which also requires packaging. Oh, packaging. Well, I haven't accounted for that yet. So we have to account for the paper from the packaging, which is probably coated with a chemical, and then the different plastic that is used to wrap that packaging. And of course, we didn't account for all the emissions from shipping these items around the world or the emissions from the energy that is used to manufacture all these products. And that is all the calculations you need just for a box of very basic pens. So you can see how extremely difficult this is. And I know pens are not part of what the EU is initially looking at, but, you know, I just wanted to use that as a nice example. So then we have a company that's importing these ballpoint pens that says, we believe these packages emits 10 tons of carbon dioxide. Well, how does the regulator ensure that information is correct? How many resources does the regulator want to put into enforcement? And can it even be enforced, since it will likely require going into other countries who probably aren't a big fan of foreign inspectors in their country? So the list of implementations goes on, including what's the country, the EU's baseline emissions that the CBAM is being accounted to, because it's usually, as I said, it's that delta between what the EU would have and what's being imported. Do you allow for emission factors? So kind of, hey, we don't actually have real numbers, or do you require actual values all the time? So the EU is in the transition phase right now for implementing the program. And for instance, they're allowing default factors right now, but are then saying you have to require actuals in the future. And on the EU's frequently asked question document, there is a question about what happens if a company is unable to obtain emissions from their suppliers. Well, the response is that it's the responsibility of the importer to provide all necessary information. So what do you do if you're an importer then? For larger importers, they may be able to tell smaller suppliers that they will go with other suppliers if that information is not provided. But for either smaller importers or companies dealing with larger suppliers, that might be difficult, if not impossible, to get that necessary information. And so that's kind of where we are with, you know, the EU, and they're in this transition phase. What that is it's a reporting program. So the requirements for the credits have not started yet. The first quarterly reports were already due to each competent national authority. So they are moving forward. They're just collecting information right now. But companies need to start performing their own risk analysis or trying to comply with these regulations. Even if you're not part of this first tranche of those regulated sectors, you should be thinking about what you would do if your sector gets pulled in. Newer sectors may or may not get the same transition times. But the big question is, do you start trying to get this information from your supply chain? Do you consider shifting your manufacturing into the EU itself? That's a way to help solve part of these problems. Do you start raising prices right now, understanding that you might be having to pay for this carbon fee in general, so there's not as much of a shock when that immediately kicks in? And once again, you know, there's all that going on. And then at the same time, just to add more regulatory uncertainty to everything, while the EU claims this is consistent with World Trade Organization requirements, India is contending that. So that could also throw in some issues if the WTO agrees with countervailing duties and who knows what else might occur. So there's a lot of unknowns when it still comes to this carbon border adjustment. The EU is still trying to figure out how to do it and how to implement it, but it's going to be a lot of work over this coming decade.
Okay. And, you know, the EU's just been very busy, and, you know, maybe because the UK left, they've got some more time on their hands. I don't know what's going on, but there are a lot of reporting rules coming out of the EU. And can you tell us just what's going on there? Why have they been so busy lately? Is it just everyone's woken up and decided it's time, or what's happening there?
So I think that, you know, we are in the digital age. There is a lot, you know, I'm not going to go down that path too much, but I do think that there is a lot more information available to everyone. So I do think that is part of the reason why there is an interest in getting their handle on what companies have and making them report more. But I'll start out with like the reasons why generally regulators want to collect information. The first, and this is coming from a former regulator myself, is that collecting information is actually considered a best practice for regulation. You know, and this has become more and more important as we talk about global supply chains, as well as we talk about chemical issues. Regulations should be based on science and the best available information. Therefore, the first step before taking any regulatory action should be getting information first, right? We don't want regulators to just do something and then collect the information afterwards and then realize they made a mistake.
Like the feedback situation?
Yes. Okay. Definitely similar to that. You know, unfortunately, like PFAS, what we see is there's too often we see pressures from various groups have regulators take action before all or even a majority of the information is known. So therefore, soliciting information for the sake of consideration of rulemaking is something that I personally support, as long as that information is actually for a regulatory action. It's not just we just want to know because we want to know. There has to be an actual real reason why the regulator wants that information. And then it's done that minimizes unnecessary cost or potential other issues related to that. So like that's the like, hey, we're doing this because it's the right thing to do reason. I'll get into some other reasons that might not be just because it's the right thing to do. The second reason is that collecting information is a good way for regulators or governments to look like they're doing something, you know, especially in response to those outside pressures I was talking about. So, you know, one of the ways to appear that you're getting a handle on a situation is to just be saying we're collecting more information. We'll see this when they send out general requests for information, but we also see this with demands for information from regulated entities. Also, it's usually easier to request or demand information than establishing new regulatory requirements. It's a quick step regulators can use to look like they're handling the situation. but, you know, you have this good reason and you have this, hey, we're just trying to look like we're doing something here. So it's really hard to actually distinguish when they're doing one to the other, because they will always say that they need this information to regulate. But sometimes, as I said, they're just doing that to look like they're doing something. The third reason is it's really hard for any company to push back on saying it's not appropriate for them to provide additional information to regulators. It was only just protected away. It's hard to say for a company that the public should not know additional information about what emissions are coming out through the air, water, and land from their facilities. It's a very hard messaging campaign, you know, and just difficult in general. And then the last reason, and this is a more sinister reason, is that if a government disfavors a certain industry or company and wants to make it more difficult for that sector or company to be able to continue operating while still being able to say they didn't kill that company or sector by regulations, making that sector or company divulge information, they can use the public to make allegations, even potentially frivolous ones, spin up other members of the public, or start a negative public campaign with the information to try and shut down that sector or company. With social media and the ease of connection and spreading messages, especially without the necessary context, it is easy to see information being manipulated for certain messages. We see this already, where citizens claim that certain emissions are too high based on their unofficial readings, and that the facility should be shut down even though the facility is permitted to have those emissions, or there are unique safety related reasons. You know, the messaging isn't this was okay, it's oh, this was not okay. And so then the company and even the regulator has to kind of push back on that. Now, turning to the future, where do we see this all going on reporting? There's going to be a lot, in my opinion, a lot more reporting requirements for the United States and EU, and that information will be used for regulations as well as provided to the public. There's a lot more information sharing to the public. It's important for companies to remember is that a lot of the information provided to regulators cannot be protected from being provided to the public. Additionally, companies may be required to do a lot of additional research to meet those reporting requirements, which then can also be made public either by the regulator or potentially through litigation. So what this means is that companies should be very careful about what they're doing and should engage counsel appropriately when performing these reviews. You know, one needs to be very careful. There's a lot of people, I'm sure the people on this call, we're all well-meaning. We want to protect the environment and we're hardworking. But putting guesses, making guesses and so forth like that in documents or emails in this day and age that can be easily taken out of context by regulators or the public could result in additional issues for the company. You know, this email that you think is completely fine and has no problem, that sentence can be just taken out of context and, as I said, sent out via social media to hundreds of thousands of people. And then additionally, this large amount of information that's going to be made public will also be used potentially against other public statements by companies. So, for example, a company can make statements about sustainability or other types of statements like PFAS, our products are PFAS free. However, based on these information requests, a company might realize that those sustainability statements may no longer be accurate based on the information they have now been provided. And so they're going to need to update their sustainability statements as well as just be cautious for any statements that are being made in the future with the additional pressure. With all this information coming in now, your suppliers might have been telling you for years there's no or not reporting that there's any PFAS, for example. But a new reporting requirement for your supplier might come in, and now you have been sent information that says there's PFAS in your product. So generally, companies should be looking at their public statements and consider looking at their supply chains just general to understand what's in your products and shipments. I'll say it is clear the governments are trying to determine what's in companies' products, and companies through their supply chain are also trying to determine whether their own suppliers have these potential liabilities. So you're also seeing your downstream and customers wanting to know what upstream customers, what are the chemicals in their products as well. So a lot more reporting, a lot more potential liability there too.
Okay. So this will be our last question before we open up to questions from the audience, because I want to make sure everyone's got time to get their questions in here. And this one is for you, Tim Turner. I know this is a big issue for you. So lots of disparate reporting between the EU, the US, individual US states. Is there a light at the end of the tunnel for this? Can you give Tim some hope?
Yeah, I'm an eternal optimist. you know, and I think you have to be in this world. I think it will get better than it currently is. There will always be differences. It might get worse before it gets better, but I think it will get better. And let's look at like a lot of the work that we've seen going on. So let's take, I mentioned the World Trade Organization before. Their technical barriers to trade was set up decades ago, recognizing the differences. So what you're seeing is initially when you had WTO, it was like laws. There's differences in laws. Okay, that's easy to show. That's a barrier to entry. Well, then countries started using regulations. And so the WTO set up this program and this organization to try and help alleviate these differences that we're talking about. You see trade agreements that now include regulatory coherence provisions to get rid of these type of things, these issues. But, you know, is it going to be ever be perfect or like, hey, you only need one, there's one super law that like you comply with that and everywhere else? No, but you see these things. I'm optimistic, as I said, USMCA have regulatory coherence. You hear, you know, I know the United States is talking about that with their trade agreements. You see this push coming, and you see that a lot of governments are seeing that with how these complex supply chains are, and that these regulatory requirements are barriers to prosperity within their own country. I think the COVID-19 pandemic was a wake-up call to governments about the importance of supply chain and regulations that prevent necessary adaptation. So I think they're realizing like, hey, we need to be able to be more flexible. And then finally, governments are realizing that companies are just going to comply with the most difficult requirements within the major sector and within the supply chain and apply those requirements potentially across the board. We saw that with tech, with GDPR, where EU's GDPR is now the de facto international standard now for data privacy. And so I think governments are realizing that they're not quick to move and there's no one solution for these disparate rules across jurisdiction. I think they're going to realize that they need to combine and look at their allies, at least that things need to be streamlined and they need to be able to make it so that companies can be able to import and export easily among their friendly countries. So I'm optimistic. I mean, as I said, it will never be perfect. You will always need EHS and compliance people. There'll always be a lot of paperwork, but I'm hopeful and I think we're going to eventually get there.
Oh, I love to end on a hopeful note. All right. What questions do you guys have that will take us out of this hopeful note, I'm assuming? So you can jump in, you can unmute yourself and come on camera, or you can type it into the chat, or you can raise your hand. You could do it that way too.
I'll jump in here. Jeff Strahan with Milliken. Nice overview there. Lurk was a review of some stuff and certainly some new stuff as well. On the one issue we have seen is a regulation comes out, and let's pick on PFAS. The number of labs that can actually do the testing that is supposed to be about to be required by 4 gajillion people gets pretty backed up pretty quickly. Is there any talk of the federal government is going to fund new labs or testing equipment? So there's about to be a huge bubble of orders of high-res mass specs to get down to these part per trillion levels. And then I learned today the drinking water limit in the EU. And is, I mean, there's just still 100 parts per trillion. Right. I mean, it's still very, very low. So is there any kind of talk of the ecosystem that you're about to create by all this testing?
So I would say the industry community is definitely talking about that a lot, as I'm sure you are with your colleagues. The regulators acknowledge that to the extent that are we going to have some big funding campaign? You know, there hasn't been as much talk that I've seen about the lack of labs from the high-ranking policymakers who realize, oh, no, we can't actually enforce a lot of this. I hope that we'll be able to get into a situation where there will be enough labs. Or you're going to result in having to do, you know, there's only three options right now, right? It's you either have to build more labs and get them up to the necessary standards. You have to either delay enforcement of it or just tell people they're going to be out of compliance. And that third one is clearly the worst. But unfortunately, there hasn't been enough talk about getting more labs up and running so that you can meet the high demand that we're seeing today with the sensitivity of the equipment that we need.
Okay, thanks.
That hopeful note just gone. It's gone. Thanks, Jeff. Right. More questions from you all.
I've got a quick question, I suppose. Jason Jenkins, I'm with Eastman Chemical. You know, so you talked about PFAS being the kind of flavor of the day, right, in terms of seeing a lot of scrutiny, regulation, et cetera. What do you see over the next 5 years in terms of additional materials coming under pressure? And kind of a corollary to that, do you see this global plastics treaty that's being negotiated now in this year having an impact on the industry as well?
Yeah, that's a great question. I will say plastics, I think you hit the nail on the head. Plastics, and specifically microplastics, are going to be the soon to be du jour. I mean, I don't think PFAS is going to go away, but you know, you always need something else to talk about. I think that's the real big issue coming is going to be plastics and microplastics. And yeah, you pointed out this UN discussion going on right now. You know, it's hard. The U.S. policy statement was very, hey, we need plastics like for the future. So we need to make sure we're not just banning stuff. Single use plastics is probably the other place that you're going to see, you know, I could see banning of single use plastics becoming more common. Micro beads, which are the, you know, before they degrade to microplastics, if you just have micro beads, which are the 5 millimeter or less, that potentially getting more scrutiny. But microplastics in general, I think, are going to be the next thing. It sounds scary to say, you know, you have thousands of pounds of plastic or whatever, you know, whatever they're using right now. But I can see that's going to be probably the next big thing. But, you know, hopefully it does not move the same way we've seen with PFAS. is my hope, and that there's a lot more information being gathered and studies being done before regulators just start moving forward.
Thank you.
So we had a question come into the chat, and it is, I understand the EU is considering action regarding D4, D5, and D6 siloxanes under the Stockholm Convention. These are essential to silicone polymer production. I was wondering if you heard of this as well and what you make of it.
I am not familiar with the D4, D5, and D6 siloxanes under the Stockholm Convention, so I cannot speak to that, but they sound like chemicals, so it would not be surprising to me that they are talking about that and looking at potentially restricting them, because that's generally what they're doing. And it kind of leads into the previous question of what could be the next big issue. I am not aware of that personally, but that could also be just another thing that's going to be covered.
The weak signals on those, but we're not sure yet.
Yeah.
Okay. More questions? All right. Well, we'll finish with just, I should have let people chat. Get in the chat. All right. So the EU deforestation regulation, it doesn't appear that the Commission has the necessary infrastructure in place to actually enforce their own regulation. From a data reporting system that can handle the geolocation information required to their process of benchmarking risk for other countries. In fact, it seems like they will be unable to meet the country benchmarking standards before December. What do you think the chances are of the Commission delaying implementation of this regulation?
I think with a lot of these implementation challenges that the EU is coming to, you're seeing them start to provide additional implementation timeframes. How long that will be is going to be the delicate balancing between the various structural pressures that they are getting, one to solve the problem versus the claim problem, that is, versus, you know, the practicality of actually being able to implement it. My hope would be that they're going to delay it until the implementation can actually be successfully done. But generally what I've seen from regulators is it's some time, but usually not enough time. But as always, you know, always prepare for the worst. So, you know, I would go in with the assumption that it's going to be just, you know, December. So even if that's not possible.
Assume the best, prepare for the worst. Is that the expression?
Yes. Especially when it comes to compliance.
All right. And we'll just wrap up with a quick look to the future. So we've already seen some weak signals that, Mark, I'll get your question in and we'll skip the look to the future. All right. Mark asks, have you been following the PFAS implementation in the state of Maine? If so, do you think there will be subsequent legislation to clarify PFAS reporting requirements or extend the time horizon?
So, Mark, I don't know. That's the intentionality, right? Yeah. So, Maine is one of the intentional PFAS, one of the intentional PFAS bans. I assume if this is on top, so Maine just modified their law, I think a week or two ago, to give two more years. So they moved it back from 2030 to 2032. They specifically exempted a number of categories that using PFAS, like medical devices and others, and have made it, it seemingly a number of categories. So they've already shown that they're going willing to extend the timeline, and you can still get exemptions, this critical use exemption, and they're working on a regulation this year. So I think the regulator will provide more clarity on the reporting requirements. If the state will keep on extending the time horizon, I'm not sure. I mean, I think maybe they're going to take a pause. I would see them taking a pause for another year or two and then maybe extending it again. I think it's up in the air. I mean, Maine, as I said, moving first, or one of the first movers with Minnesota, has realized that this is really difficult and a lot of things are covered. So I'm optimistic that they're going to get their arms around it, and they have realized how difficult this is by the law they just passed. So extending that time frame and exempting more sectors. So
that's an example of regulators trying to look busy before they actually figure out what they need to regulate. Got it.
Yes.
Yeah. And so Mark added in, it's clear the Maine EPA has had difficulty with regulating this. Yeah. Yeah. Understanding is the first step. That's my key takeaway here. We got to understand what we're regulating before we can actually regulate it. Yeah. All right. So perfect timing. So Aaron, thank you so much for sharing all of this with us. It was a lot. I hope people who listen to the podcast don't try and speed it up to 1.5 time, because that would be too fast. So thank you for taking the time today. Really appreciate you sharing all of your knowledge in this space with us. Huge thank you to all the attendees and everyone who jumped in with questions. Really appreciate your thoughts here. And thanks, everyone, and have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you so much. It was great being here. Thanks, Lee.
Thanks, Aaron.